Welcome back. This is Andy, and this is the Poor Pearl's Almanac. Today, we're joined by Dr. Peter Rosset, an agroecologist and activist based in Central America. Peter holds a number of titles as a Global Alternatives Associate at CENSA, the Center for the Study of Rural Change in Mexico. He's also the co-coordinator of the Land Research Action Network. He's a visiting research scientist at the University of Michigan, a faculty member at ECOSUR Advanced Studies and Institute in Chiapas, Mexico, and CAPE's visiting professor in the Geography Department of the Universidad Federal de Ceará, the UFC, in Brazil. Having spent the past three decades fighting for indigenous sovereignty and specifically food sovereignty, we jump into the role La Via Campesina and agroecology play in our fight against global capital and climate change. This is a really inspiring discussion and one that I think helps us frame up the recent episode on agroecology and what that looks like in practice. I highly, highly recommend Peter's book and much of his writing, which highlights what ground-up, people-centered food systems can look like and gives us some tools for a way forward. Listen in and let us know what you think. Peter, thanks so much for coming on. So you're involved in a number of different things. The big one I think that folks listening are probably most familiar with is La Via Campesina. Now, for folks that are unfamiliar, could you give us like a really quick rundown on the organization?
Yeah, the Via Campesina is a global social movement that's made up of mostly national organizations of family farmers, peasants, farm workers, indigenous people, rural women, rural youth, and other people who live in rural areas in more than 80 countries in the world. And it's very big because those organizations, when taken together, more than 200 million rural families around the world. That means that La Via Campesina, after the big religions like Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, the Via Campesina is like the next largest movement of human beings on planet Earth. And it's people struggling together to defend our relationship with nature, to defend life in rural areas, to defend healthy food, to defend access to land for the rural poor, and a number of other issues that all sort of fit together.
It's surreal how big it is because it's so ubiquitous in so much of the world, but not here in the United States.
And although I will say that in the United States, the members of La Via Campesina, there are several members. One of them is the National Family Farm Coalition, which is a coalition of more than 30 local and regional organizations around the country, the Rural Coalition, which is also national with many local organizations, and the Florida Farm Workers Union. So there actually is a presence of La Via Campesina. It sort of, I think, suffers, maybe they all collectively suffer from some kind of a media blackout or media ignoring them, which is one of the reasons it's great that this program and this podcast is going to cover some of these issues.
Yeah, thank you. When it comes to La Via Campesina, one of the frameworks of the movement is in agroecology. And that's very specific because of the politics of agroecology, if you want to just give a really quick, again, rundown on that.
Well, I you know, there's different views of agroecology and the sort of the cold Western science view. It's the science of how agricultural systems work. But it's been taken up by people's movements around the world. And for people's movements, what agroecology really means is instead of farming against nature and against people, the way that industrial agriculture and agribusiness farms in huge areas, mechanized, not a tree in sight, not a human being's house in sight. If there are any workers at all, they're being paid below minimum wage with no benefits and no job security. So that's destroying the soil, destroying biodiversity. So that would be agriculture against nature. Agroecology would be farming with nature, using the ecosystem, using diversity, mixing different crops together in the same field, mixing crops and trees and livestock in sustainable ways where nutrients are recycled, and with a heavy dose of social justice politics as well, because it's a way for human beings to live well, not to be rich, but to live well with each other and also with nature. and a way to provide a better livelihood for people in rural areas. So aside from the sort of the narrow Western science concept, agroecology is more like a social movement, or a social movement that overlaps with many other social movements, like the way it overlaps with La Via Campesina and the way Via Campesina has taken it up.
Yeah, you mentioned this, the like hard science component. I think of like the Odum brothers
As being kind of that side of the agroecology
Right.
movement.
We could talk about how that's kind of manifested over the last 50 years into something very different. I heard you talk on this in a discussion about agroecology, and you described it in this way, and I'm going to take a quote from you. And you said, agroecology is a mass collective action in resistance to agribusiness and trying to transform rural territories from agribusiness territories into the family farming and peasant territories. And that's the end of the quote. How do you see like agroecology do this successfully in places like the United States? And then I guess if you feel comfortable, like maybe how that, what agroecology offers versus say organic or permaculture or something like that.
Well, I think we could ask why has agroecology and even organic farming taken off much more in countries in the global south than it has, for example, in the United States and Europe. And I think on the one side there are technical explanations, on the other side there are political explanations. On the technical side, the sort of vision of organic production that dominates in the global north is a vision that's not all that different from an agribusiness, industrial agriculture monoculture based on purchased inputs like chemical fertilizer and pesticide and machinery and irrigation equipment. What that kind of business-oriented organic production, the only thing that it changes in that is it takes out the chemical inputs and puts in organic biological inputs. And that's actually a very weak position for challenging dominant agribusiness, because those alternative biological inputs tend to be more expensive and less potent than the chemicals that they're placing. And so therefore, consumers end up having to pay more for organic because it's produced in the same way as industrial conventional agriculture with less potent and more expensive inputs, and somebody's got to pay for that. And it ends up being the consumer, and that means that it pretty much goes to an elite customer base, people with high purchasing power, upper middle class, who can afford to eat that kind of an organic diet. Because on the technical side, there's no challenge to the monoculture structure of industrial agriculture. And a monoculture, the way agribusiness produces because of their need to mechanize huge areas, is incredibly unproductive per unit of area, because you only have one thing being produced on each hectare, only soybeans or only corn or only apple trees. And while you may have a high yield of corn or a high yield of soybeans, if you compare that to a peasant farm on the same hectare, there's no peasant in the world who would only be producing one crop. They would have maybe 9 to 15 different annual crops, 10 or 11 different tree crops, three or four different kinds of large and small livestock, perhaps a fish pond. They'd be recycling nutrients, like the waste product from the animals will be fertilizer for the crop. The part of the crop that's not for human consumption will be composted, returned to the soil as fertilizer, or fed to the animals. And so, in fact, we've studied how productive per hectare in terms of the productivity of all the products is a small peasant plot compared to the same unit of area of a large agribusiness plot. And it turns out that contrary to all of the myths that we get in dominant media and political discourse, the peasant agriculture would be way more productive per hectare than the industrial monoculture. And unfortunately, organic farming in the North pretty much leaves that intact. Those of us who work in agroecology will say it's not even agroecological, the organic production, because agroecology is more like, let's take the different parts of the system and integrate them together so that they have a catalytic effect. As I mentioned, you can use the waste of animals as fertilizer for the crop. You can use crop leftovers as compost for fertilizing the soil or as feed for the animals. Industrial livestock depends on millions of hectares of corn and soybeans being grown somewhere else in the world and shipped to where the livestock are. Livestock production on family farms or peasant farms can produce all of the feed for the livestock on the same hectare where the livestock is. So on the technical side, real agroecological farming can be much more productive and have much lower cost because you're not buying any inputs. You're using synergisms within the different systems, companion planting so that one plant repels the pests of the other instead of buying a chemical or biological or organic pesticide. So it can have higher productivity and lower production costs. That means in theory, it could actually get to the consumer cheaper than the unhealthy food that comes from agribusiness and industrial agriculture. Yet on the technical side, we almost don't see that approach in countries in the north like the United States and Europe. And then on the political side, the whole social justice part of agroecology has not been really addressed that much in countries like the United States. So you'll find, for example, organic farmers, small-scale agribusiness hiring migrant farm workers at below minimum wage and no benefits, no health care, no housing. And so that would be completely inconceivable in the more political versions of agroecology that we see in the global South. So I feel like a lot of work has to be done to bring together a mixture of both the political and the social, as well as the technical aspect of agroecology in order to give a little bit more force to the alternatives in the global North. Of course, it's not easy because there's so much lock-in for even family farmers or small farmers, just in terms of, for example, bank loans. If you had loans in the past, in order to not have the bank call in your debt and confiscate your house and your land, you have to continue to produce with more loans. And every year for your loans, you have to give the bank a business plan. And they want to see monoculture production and what chemicals are you going to buy and what tractor are you going to upgrade to in order to approve the continuation of your loans. Otherwise, they'll call it all in and you're out of business. So, you know, there has to be a broad-based political struggle against all of those forms of lock-in.
You've made a bunch of really good points. And I think there's one thing that kind of makes the United States uniquely challenged by like engaging with agroecology in a way that you may not see so much in the South, and or the global South at least, is the relationship between the land and its people, right? So obviously, both Americas have a history of colonialism, but the United States, because of genocide, the relationship between a majority of the population is very different, I think, than,
you know, where you are, which is right now Brazil.
Right, yeah.
But you were in Mexico for a while as well. And I'm curious about what your thought of like what a land-based movement might have to look like here, where we don't maybe have that ancestral tech-informed knowledge that shapes a lot of those relationships.
Well, as you've mentioned, colonialism, and I think the fact that North America is more of what's called settler colonialism, as you mentioned the word genocide, it was based on stealing all of the land from indigenous people and killing them. And so that means that, as you were insinuating, which is completely correct, that broke any kind of, what do you call it, transmission of ancestral knowledge to current generations of farmers, of how the grandparents or great grandparents farmed before all this stuff was available, which is kind of the kind of knowledge that's readily available in countries like Mexico, where that ancestrality is still there. Of course, it is with the Native American and Indigenous Peoples Movement in the United States, and we actually do see some very good examples of smaller scale agroecology amongst the Native American or original American movement and the small territories that are left to them. But this whole issue also of who does the land really belong to, I think, casts a very dark shadow over agriculture and farming in the United States. And, you know, I have to say to our listeners that I haven't lived in the United States for about 30 or 40 years. So I feel a little bit detached from it. Of course, obviously, I was born there and grew up in the United States. But I feel I have more experience now in countries where, of course, as you say, we're also colonized, we're also conquered, also had genocide, but not as complete a genocide and not as complete a land robbing or land stealing as in the U.S. So, for example, Mexico, which is my home base, about 50% of the land is actually in the hands of mostly indigenous farmers. And we certainly couldn't say that in the United States. And yeah, here in Brazil, where I'm right now, It has a very unequal land distribution like the US, but a very powerful movement of people who lost their land doing land occupations to get their land back, the Landless Workers Movement, or MST, which actually has now got back an area larger than the country of Italy of landless farmers who've recovered their land through land occupations and are mostly practicing agroecology on it.
That's awesome. So how did you end up in South America or Central America in the first place?
You know, I would say I've come from the Vietnam War and the Black Power movement generation in the United States. So when I was in middle school, we alternated between going to anti-war moratoriums and Black Panther rallies. So I grew up in a very politicized way. That meant that I always felt a strong appeal from third world revolutionaries. I remember in junior high and high school having a poster of Che Guevara in my bedroom. So I had this strong affinity, let's say, for Latin American struggles. And so at a certain point in my life, I was active in solidarity with Latin American movements. And the opportunity came when there was a people's revolution in the country of Nicaragua in 1979, and they asked for international technical personnel to come and help the new Ministry of Agriculture because many of their agronomists and scientists had been reactionaries who fled when the dictatorship was overthrown, and they needed support from foreign technical people while they trained up their own new generation of people. And so that started a long voyage of my life where I have occasionally lived back in the United States, but mostly have lived in different countries in Latin America since then.
Oh, that's awesome. You were down there just at the tail end. We did last season an episode on Efraim Hernandez. So like the school lockouts and all that crazy stuff that he was involved with.
Yeah.
You know, here, as you know, Spanish speaker, I'm assuming.
Yes.
The amount of information that leaks out from Central America, you know, like Efraim Hernandez, there's almost nothing written on him in English.
Yeah.
So like trying to highlight a lot of those stories that like there's these really cool histories that we have no idea about that reinforce a lot of these beliefs that frame up these ideas of agroecology and ethnobotany.
Yeah. Latin America has been a school for me, just living and accompanying social movements, peasant movements, indigenous peoples movements in Latin America. I've learned far more than I ever learned in the university and graduate school in the United States.
Yeah, it does offer some really good insights. And again, I'm going to bring back to that question I had a minute ago about, given the context of the United States, do you have any thoughts about how we could push, like, As a white male, cis white male guy, what do I do if I don't have a podcast like this to try to, you know, reinforce, live my beliefs about like what an ethical agricultural system looks like? What should I be doing?
You know, that's a difficult question, and maybe that's why I don't live in the United States. So I don't have to face it on a daily basis. You know, but I think there are some principles, but all of those principles are confused by politics in the United States, I have to say. So, you know, one principle would be to try to buy food locally from local farmers, but the whole politics of rural America is very unfortunate. And I think that we have both the Democrats and the Republicans equally to blame for that historically, because both parties have essentially ignored the reality of rural life and allowed repeated farm crises due to bad policies to cause the life to become incredibly precarious for everybody who lives in rural America, whether they're Latin American or Haitian farm workers, whether they're indigenous people pushed onto a reservation, or whether they're white family farmers in debt up to their ears or over their heads with banks and stuck in the agribusiness model that's bleeding them dry. And really no governments have done anything. And I'm not quite sure why somehow the Democrats have got the blame for that in the mind of a lot of white people in rural America. But I think that's unfortunate, because I think that their gripe are legitimate. And there has been a tremendous abandonment and allow agribusiness and banks to run roughshod over people of all colors, all ethnicities, all historical backgrounds, and make them all rightfully very mad. But of course, it seems like the far right has been better at exploiting that anger. And that means that it's more complicated. If you want to be ethical, but you don't want to you don't want to support neo-Nazis, you want to support indigenous people, Latinos, but Latinos don't have land. They're working as farm workers for agribusiness. It's all very complicated. I always try to follow, if the farm workers have a strike or a boycott, I try to support that. If indigenous people are demanding something on a land claim or blocking a pipeline, I try to support that. And if family farmers are demanding a different price parity policy for family farm agriculture, I support that. I try to take my cues from people's movements, and I do try to buy locally to the extent that one's pocketbook can support that. And of course, that goes back to the problem that I mentioned before, that unfortunately, the form of organic that's taken hold so far in the North means that it's basically a product for elite consumption. It doesn't have to be. Agroecology shows that it could be more affordable than even than supermarket food, but it hasn't worked out that way yet. So there's a big struggle still ahead for people in the US.
Absolutely. I wish, unfortunately, you don't have a silver bullet.
Which would be really nice.
Yeah, those don't exist, unfortunately.
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
I'm also, you've been doing this a long time. You were, like you said, you're in Brazil. You'd spent some time in Zapatista territory. And I'm curious about that time that you've spent and kind of how you've seen agroecology kind of evolve as, I guess, the novelty of revolution wore off and, life just continues on, right? How you've seen that evolve, develop, and kind of how that's moving going into the future.
I see agroecology itself began completely alternative. And so whether we're talking about the northern country variants, whether we call it organic or permaculture or whatever, whether we talk about the traditional farming practices of peasants and indigenous people in the global south, for the first decades, it was completely ignored by the agriculture establishment, whether we're talking about ag schools or whether we're talking about companies or whether we're talking about government policy, completely ignored. As it began to gain strength, then they began to ridicule it as this is just kind of whacked out stuff by crazy folks on the fringe. But as the movement grew and as it actually in many countries produced a very significant amount of food and very healthy food and more people get involved, finally, the establishment and the broadest sense of the establishment of institutionality has had to recognize agroecology, but now it's trying to co-opt agroecology as a sort of underpinning for green agribusiness or greenwashing of agribusiness. So agribusiness will still be based on large-scale land grabbing from family farmers and peasants, will still be monoculture, will still support giant chemical companies like Bayer Monsanto, who will now produce biological or organic inputs, will still support John Deere tractors and combines, and will still be marketed through global supermarket chains, except it'll be organic. So that's the way the green discourse in general has been appropriated. Whether we're talking about renewable energy, we can see the same thing. It's a sort of a broad co-optation of all of the green discourse by capitalism in general, but specifically in agriculture, we now have to fight for our view of agroecology, because now suddenly it's been discovered by the capitalist establishment and they're trying to now claim that it's theirs. And this is why it's fine to buy your organic food in the organic aisle in Walmart, and you don't need to bother to go to a local farmer's market in order to buy your organic food if you're going to buy organic. And so we now are facing a completely different situation. We used to be fighting for legitimacy to be taken seriously, and now we're being fought to not have the whole thing stolen out from under us, the same way that the land was stolen out from under from so many small farmers around the world.
Yeah, it was just a few years ago that there was a big consortium in Africa against, I believe it was the FAO, about using agroecology, but then stripping it of all its political background.
Right, and that's the tendency, is to take just some of the technical components of agroecology and completely ignore the politics, and that be a way to legitimize the business as usual model.
Yeah. You've been working in these regions. I'm curious about how you see the knowledge and the experiences, the lived experiences of developing these systems and applying them to places where they're at early stages of agroecology, like Rojava, where there's a very specific interest in agroecology, but applying it seems to be a struggle because of the economic conditions and, in many cases, lack of resources to restore indigenous plants, the struggles of bringing back traditional foodways and all of the components of late stage capitalism being boiled down into like a functionally an area that's surrounded by a war zone. I'm interested, as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, what your thoughts are, if there should be more integration between these communities or, anything like that.
Well, I think that we have to see it as not just changing technical practices, but as political struggle. And political struggle requires building social movements ranging from the very local to the regional, to the national, to the global. And of course, La Via Campesina is all about that global part. But so many of the barriers to these pro to the growth of these processes of agroecology, of local farming, of empowering local people, so many of the barriers are more in the policy and political and economic structure sphere, that we're only going to achieve real change or a upscaling of these alternatives through political struggle. Or we have to have both. We have to have people innovating and developing alternatives at the local level, and to the extent that they can build spaces of relative autonomy. You, for example, mentioned the Zapatistas in Mexico, who are famous for their autonomous territories. That helps model the alternative society and practices that we would like to see, even on a more local scale. But that should be synergistic with a larger political struggle that can also point to it and say, look, we have examples that this works, and that's why we're struggling to make these larger changes at the political level. So it ha they ha has to be grouped together in larger social movements and political mobilization. And I don't see anything not centered around political mobilization that really offers any hope for changing these kind of structural elements.
Yeah, and I know you were in Cuba a few years ago, and you got to see the Organopanicos. Of course, I'm never going to be able to pronounce that right because I'm recording.
Organoponicos.
Yes.
And you were able to see it, and kind of how did that reflect agroecology and the historical context of Cuba? And like, how did it compare to what you've experienced so far since Cuba's been so segregated from much of the world?
Yeah, I mean, the problem that Cuba faces is the U.S. embargo, as it's called in the U.S., and the U.S. blockade, as the rest of the world calls it, which is more than half a century where the U.S. has assured that Cuba can't have any trade partners, especially after the collapse of the former socialist bloc in Europe. And that means that Cuba, long time ago, had an industrial agriculture like most of the world, with tractors and large-scale monoculture and imported fertilizer and pesticides. But when the U.S. started blockading their ability to have any international trade, they either would have had to starve to death or figure out how to produce enough food on their own without importing anything from multinationals or from no longer existing socialist countries. So they have two very interesting lessons that at least that I've learned from the Cuban experience. One is in the cities with urban agriculture, and that's what you mentioned are the organoponicos, are organic plots within the city. And people who live in the U.S., I think, are familiar with urban agriculture, but on a much smaller scale. In Cuban cities, something like 90% of all perishable vegetables are produced within the city or the peri-urban area. and are produced without any chemicals and generate employment and income for a lot of underemployed urban people, and all produced organically. And I think nobody's going to replicate the conditions of Cuba, having a socialist revolution and being blockaded. But it does, at least on the side of showing what's possible, that, you know, if we had a different policy environment, a different politics, we could have much more self-sufficient production of food, and it could be much healthier. And we certainly haven't resolved the problem of underemployment or poor jobs in urban areas in the U.S. And there's certainly a lot of abandoned land in the inner city. So it's not like it couldn't be done, but the conditions are not favorable to it. But Cuba at least shows us that it can be done. And then in the rural area, what I really love is what they call the campesino, or peasant to peasant, or farmer to farmer model. And this is based on the idea that if we want to produce ecologically our food, we should remember that most places in the world, people used to produce that way before all of these chemicals and commercial seeds and machinery came in. When it all came in, that knowledge, a lot of that knowledge was broken into little pieces and dispersed in the community. But even in the U.S., you can't really go to a farm community without people saying, oh, yeah, that crazy old lady has all of the original kind of delicious apple trees that we used to grow here before agribusiness came in, or that old guy has the local race of hogs that have way better bacon, but nobody can grow them because all of the slaughterhouses have been monopolized by the meat multinationals, and you're not allowed to slaughter your own meat. So the peasant idea is based on that. Let's find those people who still know how to do things, who still have the old seeds, the old trees, the old livestock races, and let's try to create a community process where, instead of the community seeing them as crazy old folks, see them as wise people, as a source of wisdom, knowledge, heirloom seeds, local chicken, animal, pig, cow races that do much better without buying balanced animal feed from Purina, but based on local forage plants, and let's try to take that knowledge that everybody used to have before industrial agriculture came in, but then it got atomized into little pieces through our farmer organization. Let's survey, let's find the people, let's find the knowledge, let's create workshops where they share that knowledge back into the larger community. And a lot of that knowledge actually allows, and Cuba really shows this, allows people to solve a lot of the problems they have in their production with rediscovering these practices that have actually been proven for hundreds of years that work very well under local conditions. So that's the other great lesson from Cuba, is how a farmer-to-farmer process is really much better than a top-down process in terms of sharing knowledge and through sharing knowledge, transforming agricultural practices. And then we marry that with the urban agriculture, that cities could actually produce a lot of their food very healthily. And then I think we see two ways that Cuba offers very important lessons for those of us who are working on these issues in the rest of the world.
That's awesome. I wish I could visit, but unfortunately I live here in the United States.
I don't know if you know the old Phil Oaks song, but when they first had the U.S. government put the travel ban on U.S. citizens not being able to go to Cuba, the first guy to break the travel ban, his name was William Worthy. And the words of the song is, William Worthy isn't worthy to be an American no more. You're living in the free world, and in the free world, you must stay.
He's very, very poignant.
Poignant words. Yeah.
Great American freedom, but you can't travel to Cuba. That's not allowed. That's
God
not
forbid
the
you see something else.
Yeah. So you wrote a book, Agroecology, Science, and Politics. It's a great text, basically, somewhere between text and just a philosophical point about how agriculture should look and the way that it dovetails with politics. And this idea of, like, there's no social equity without that ecological equity, and vice versa, that you cannot solve ecological problems if you don't address these social problems, right? And I think it's a particularly helpful book. And I'm curious about how do you envision all of this kind of playing out over the next few decades, especially with, like, climate change ramping up and challenging not just our conventional agricultural system, but even, like, the way historical tech has been applied if climates are fundamentally changing?
Yeah, well, I think two things. We're and on the self-promotion side, it's a small book, and it was written for a series of books called small books that tell us about the state of the art of big subjects. So we try to write it in a
It's
condensed
like
way
120 page, right?
and in an accessible language, so somebody who knows nothing about the science and politics of agroecology could get up to speed in a couple of days. Let's put it that way. That's the idea of the book. Now, climate change is a big problem. It's a great opportunity for agroecology, but it's also a great threat for agroecology because the whole climate change has fed in to this appropriation of the green discourse by global capitalism. And so we find a lot of very negative processes being justified under the green framework of addressing climate change. So many countries that I visited around the world, and I understand, for example, even sometimes happens in the US, these windmill farms and offshore windmills, wind turbines, which completely destroy the local environment and drive local people off the land, are sold as the alternative for renewable energy, or solar panel plantations, which are parks which raise local temperatures by 6 degrees, killing wildlife, killing biodiversity, making it impossible for people to live anywhere near them, and are produced by global corporations, the same ones that brought us fossil fuel. So these are what we call fake solutions to climate change, or fake solutions to the whole nexus of environmental problems that we have. And in a sense, they're a threat to things like agroecology because they're actually driving small farmers off of the land so that giant corporations can have wind turbine parks or solar parks or large-scale dams or other things like that that are now being sold under the green discourse. Yet on the other hand, and we call those, as I said, fake solutions. Real solutions would be to relocalize our food system and have our food be produced by local farmers using agroecology in ways that don't emit greenhouse gases and actually address in a real way the real dimensions and underlying causes of the climate crisis, where almost half of all greenhouse gas emissions comes from the food system, from long distance transport, from using farm chemicals, from clearing forests for large scale industrial monoculture. A relocalized agroecological farming system would address all of those underlying causes. So that would be in the category of what we call real solutions. So we have to visibilize the fact that we're being sold false solutions by governments and corporations, but in fact, we have in our hands as people real solutions. And so I think we have to recast the debate about climate change and about the global environmental crisis. And this is something that La Vía Campesina tries to do as a debate between false solutions and real solutions. And therefore, instead of the threat of the false solutions being yet another way that drives human beings off the land, have the real solutions a way that strengthens people's relationship to the land, access to the land, and addresses in a real way the underlying causes of climate change.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I definitely think you've given some folks some food for thought to think about. For folks that are interested in your work, want to read more of your writing, where can they find you? Are you on social media? Anywhere to get your words?
Yeah, because I'm an academic nowadays, a lot of what I write are in academic publications, scientific journals, and most of that is available on the internet. Many people don't know in the Google search engine, there's something called Google Scholar. And if you put my name in Google Scholar, you'll find about 100 different scientific articles on agroecology. And then you can click through them. And some of them, the actual scientific journal they were published in has a paywall, and you don't want to pay $30 for the article, believe me. But if you look around, you'll usually find somebody's posted a PDF for free of the same thing. So a lot of that is available that way. And I'm also on Facebook, not on Twitter or Instagram, but people can find me on Facebook, and I put a lot of information there as well. And I highly recommend going to the website of La Vía Campesina, which is viacampesina.org, and also follow some of the Vía Campesina member organizations in the U.S., for example, such as the Na National Family Farm Coalition, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, that they're kind of blacked out from the media, but they do believe in and struggle in favor of many of these same things that we've been talking about today.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'll
And
definitely
also,
provide those.
the farm worker movement, the Latino Haitian farm worker movement, also is closely related, a lot of it, to Villa Campesina, and also has very similar struggles.
Yeah, I'll definitely include those links in the show notes, as well as a link to your book. I know a bunch of your articles are in the Journal of Peasant Studies, which I'd never heard of, I think, until I started reading some of your work, and it's a fantastic publication. There's a lot of really good stuff in there.
Yeah, I recommend it a lot. I read it all the time.
Yeah. So, Peter, thanks so much. This has been fantastic.
Well, I enjoyed it very much as well. Thank you for the great questions and for the great conversation.